Welcome to our seminar on this beautiful Monday. We have with us Katrin Snell, who will present on collective patterns on bird migration. Katrin, would you like to introduce yourself quickly, or shall I?
Oh, you can.
Yeah, okay. Well, Katrin is a member of the migration department of the Max Planck Institute of Animal Behavior, and she came to Konstanz on a Marie Curie fellowship, and since recently she has been a postdoc grant fellow of the cluster and doing very interesting and very fascinating work on migratory birds, and we're very happy that she can present some of her work today and very excited. So thank you, Katrin.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to talk and present today. Throughout my career, I've worked in animal migration, and I've been investigating using tracking technologies. And today I would like to invite you to think about the potential role of collective at a much larger scale than we're used to. So conspecific and heterospecific interactions at a global scale over the course of an entire annual cycle. So I'm interested in how the environment shapes animal behaviors and their interactions, and how this is balanced with intrinsic physiological and regulatory control of behavior and energetics. So my work primarily explores how movement influences higher order processes, such as demography, speciation and differentiation, and distribution. And I've also been inspired by a lot of the tools from collective behavior to explore some of these themes. So I'm excited to share some of the recent work I've been involved in and had the pleasure to lead. And I'd also like to share some thoughts and discussions about future directions and collaborations with the cluster. So I'd like to introduce you to one study system and species groups that I've worked with throughout my career. This is the Arctic skua, or the parasitic Jäger. So familiar to German speakers amongst you, the parasitic hunter. It has a number of absolutely fascinating traits, including those that make it inextricably linked to cons and heterospecific seabird interactions. It has a breeding range throughout the Arctic and the subantarctic, and it breeds in colonies with densities varying throughout its range and habitats it occupies. For example, in Scotland and the Faroe Islands, breeding colonies are really dense. The nests can be about 50 meters apart, and they're associated with other seabird species. Whereas further north in the high Norwegian Arctic, where the landscape is much more expansive, they're much further apart. It also has the additional benefit of making them very easy to monitor in the field. For example, long-term population monitoring and behavioral observations. Although much of the population breeds high in the Arctic, so there's still many regions where we have a lot of data gaps for. It's migratory, and its strategy can be described as a true migrant. So it has long distance directed seasonal movements between discrete areas. And that's in contrast to many seabird species that just have a non-breeding dispersal out into the open ocean and come back for breeding. It's a K-selective species, meaning that it's long-lived life history strategy with delayed onset of breeding, and it lays 1 to 2 eggs a year. It's also highly monogamous, so if it loses its partner, it can be a number of years before it starts successfully breeding again. And it is an absolute top predator in the marine and terrestrial realms. So it utilizes obligate kleptoparasitism, which means that it basically just beats up other seabirds, steals its food, also being highly generalized in its prey types, which is an extremely impressive behavior in the field. But this trait also means that the Arctic skua is entirely dependent on other seabird species to provision for itself and its young. Oops. Their diet is composed of extremely varied prey types, depending on the habitat, availability in the season, but also its flight biomechanics are incredibly interesting. So it enables it to undertake these long distance migrations, but also these high intensity chase flights that you can see here. So as such, it's an excellent candidate for as an indicator species for the health of the marine ecosystem. And furthermore, they're big enough in order to instrument with, for example, GLS and GPS loggers. So in 2016, together with Shura Hammer from the Faroe Islands, we began an intensive field season. We conducted a national census on Fulloy. I initiated population monitoring, breeding, thermal physiology, and movement studies. This included the deployment of GPS loggers to investigate foraging energy budgets, and together with a large consortium across the North Atlantic, we deployed and retrieved archival GLS loggers. So these are robust and lightweight. They're about 2.5 grams. They can be leg mounted on a ring on the bird, and they're essentially a light level sensor and a clock. And they work on the principle of obtaining a position estimate of longitude from the time of local noon and latitude from the day length. And they're still widely used, and they've given researchers an unprecedented insights into movement ecology of many, many long distance bird species and other migrants. And from changes in patterns of light levels, it's also possible to determine some other behaviors, such as the onset of incubation. So together with collaborators from 12 sites, we generated an unprecedented data set of migratory movements from multiple discrete populations across the habitats and latitudes. So with a multi-population data set spanning a whole species range, we can start answering some fundamental ecological questions, such as how birds are connected during the non-breeding season, the timings and carryover effects of their strategy on breeding success, their overall survival, and the variance in migratory strategies. So the first study I want to talk about was led by Rob van Belman from the Wageningen Marine Institute and the Norwegian Institute for Nature Research. We were interested in how the wintering connectivity and phenology in a long distance migrant and how these timings of key events throughout the annual cycle influence higher level processes. In long distance migrants, these timings are generally tightly scheduled, and unless they are buffered, variation in optimized schedules can carry over and impact fitness. We used a conceptual framework of two interrelated measures of timing and duration of key periods in the annual cycle. And we assume that the population mean represents an overall optimized timing. So for example, essentially we have an event, first event and a second event. If there's a delay, it can be fully compensated if the timing reverts to the population mean. This could also be completely carried over or exacerbated. And in a modeling context, we're basically looking at the slopes of these patterns between timing and duration. So we use these leg-mounted light-level geolocators to obtain daily position estimates and behaviors. Some individuals, we have data for multiple years. In fact, almost half of all the individuals that we instrumented, we've got multiple year data for. Breeding sites across the range in the North Atlantic were from 60 to 80 degrees north, and they encompass different habitats, colony structures, and main prey species. So we identified the timing of key events, such as departure from the wintering area, arrival at the wintering area, departure from the wintering area, arrival at the North Atlantic staging area, and return to the breeding area, and then, importantly, clutch initiation. So we found that they used a huge whole ocean basin area, they had travel speeds of up to 850 kilometers per day and traveled up to 15,000 kilometers, the longest migrations. So we assessed whether the wintering in certain areas led to earlier or later arrival compared to birds from the same breeding area. We assessed that constructing Bayesian general linear mixed models with breeding and wintering areas, the fixed effects, and then random intercepts for the individuals. And then from that, we extracted the variance components from the models. And we also used those to calculate the marginal repeatability between individuals. And we found that there was an increase in consistency in timing from wintering to breeding area, and that in the duration, the greatest consistency occurred in the North Atlantic staging area. We also calculated the strength of these relationships, so using the slopes between the duration of each period and the timing of its start as the Arctic skuas attract from the breeding areas in the North Atlantic to the wintering areas in the throughout the Atlantic. And the thick lines here is the overall species mean, and the thin lines is the population means. And these plots are all have a fixed ratio of 1:1. So we find that both between and within breeding populations, the duration of each migration phase was shorter when they started later. But we found that it was a complete compensation. So despite all this variation from breeding departure, there was a complete compensation by the time birds were in their wintering areas. We found a very tight relationship between timing and duration in the following stages. So in the spring migration, but then we found a partial to a complete carryover effect from the timing of the arrival at that North Atlantic staging area and their return to the colonies, which suggests that there may be some carryover effect and impact on fitness at this last stage of their migration. So in summary, we found extensive individual differences in migratory strategies. So this huge amount of mixing between populations throughout the Atlantic basin during the non-breeding season. And that these wintering areas were discrete oceanographic regions, and they were highly consistent between individuals over the years. So the same birds were going to the same sites, but each year, but not necessarily with members of the same population. And in fact, we have birds that were, each bird in a pair were tagged, and the same breeding pair were going to completely different sites, but they were returning highly synchronously back at the breeding sites. And it wasn't just the pairs, it was all members of the same population that were arriving in a highly synchronized manner within that population, but not between populations. We found that breeding at higher latitudes led not only to the later reproduction and migration, but also a faster spring migration and a shorter time between the breeding area and the clutch initiation, with more distant areas associated with more time spent on migration and less time in the wintering areas in the South Atlantic. So skuas adjusted their period that they spent in the wintering areas, regardless of their migration distance. And this buffered the variation in timing of autumn migration. It highlights the importance of the role of the wintering area and the dynamics of the migration cycle. But surprisingly, the choice of wintering area only had minor effects on the timing of migration, the timing returning to the breeding area and the spring migration. And any effects weren't consistent between populations. So this resulted in that highly synchronized arrival back at the breeding sites. We did find some evidence of a carryover effect from the North Atlantic region back to the breeding sites in the subarctic and Arctic, and which may influence productivity and hence fitness differences between populations. So the other component of fitness is survival. The life history trait theory indicates that with long-lived vertebrates like the Arctic skua, adult survival is the major determinant of fitness, and therefore population dynamics and the environmental buffer hypothesis states that in long-lived species, adult survival is generally buffered against environmental conditions. So this is a component that we're really interested to explore some more. For this, we focused on the Faroe Islands breeding population situated between the UK and Iceland, And it's close to the southern extent of the breeding range. It winters throughout the South Atlantic and it's normally coastally, utilizing the Canary currents down to the Patagonian shelf. And for the Faroe Islands, there is also ringing data dating back over 75 years from the Danish Bird Ringing Center at the Natural History Museum of Denmark, which can be used for survival modeling. So this project was co-led by my master's student Ines Santos from Copenhagen University, who was also conducting fieldwork in the Faroes, so experienced firsthand how precious this resource of long-term ringing data is to collect in the first instance. So we used a subset of 24 of the 24 most recent years of ringing data, which was most consistent in terms of ringing and re-encounter effort. And the data sets includes birds ringed as adults, like the ones that were instrumented with the tracking devices, and as chicks. Re-encounters included rings being read in the field, recapture and dead recoveries. So this was formally modeled within a capture mark recapture framework, which also accounts for re-encounter probabilities and fidelity. And we included environmental indices as covariates. So we wanted to assess how these components of the annual cycle could influence overall survival probabilities. And this is important as population dynamics should in principle be most sensitive to adult survival. We might expect that there is some scope for environmental buffering on mortality. We tested the influence of stochastic oceanic indices governing a suite of conditions during the non-breeding and the breeding periods. So we selected the El Nino Index and the North Atlantic Oscillation. And these capture a variation in sea surface temperature, winds, precipitation, which in turn they drive storm genesis and fluctuations in marine prey abundance. We also just tested trends over time, and model support was a measure of AIC corrected for small sample size. And what we found was no influence of environmental conditions on adult survival, but a distinct decrease in adult survival over time. In young birds, we had equal support for a negative trend, so a decrease in survival over time, but also the impact of the El Nino Southern Oscillation, so the ONI index, on survival. So in years with an El Nino effect, survival was higher, and a La Nina survival was lower. This suggests that there's an influence of the non-breeding area on overall survival. But perhaps what's most worrying are these two negative trends that we detected. In the southern extent of the range, like many seabird species throughout the world, and particularly migratory seabird species, population declines are dramatic and so incredibly worrying. So over the last 30 years, there's around about an 80% reduction in abundance of seabirds, of these Arctic skuas, and the similar trends are found in many of the seabird species that they're predating on. This is currently under revision, it has impacts for conservation, but also how we understand the impact of the environment on survival processes. So from that first tracking study, we saw that time spent in the North Atlantic region during spring migration may impose a cost or carryover effect on productivity and condition of the condition of the non-breeding regions contributes to mortality in those young birds. So finally, we wanted to delve a bit deeper into how and where birds are utilizing that vast ocean basin on migration. This paper was led by Nino Hanlon from the BTO and it's a sister publication of the phenology study that I just presented. So you can see that the breeding areas, firstly, you can see that we used a subset here of breeding areas, excluding those with small sample sizes. And this includes still tracks from 131 individuals, with around half of them multiple year tracking. So let's just look at the migration tracks here. There's a huge amount of variation. Now, light level geolocators for the marine species also include a saltwater switch, which is effectively measure conductivity at 10-minute intervals. So we can use this to assess whether the bird is sitting on the water to indicate foraging or resting if wet, or undertaking migratory flight if it's dry. And we utilize this to in a two-state hidden Markov model to classify transit flights from stopovers. This is particularly important to assess key utilization areas from an unbiased daily behavioral budget during the periods around the equinoxes, because if anyone's aware of the navigation theory that during the equinoxes, latitude information cannot be derived from light levels. It could be day length is the same throughout the longitude. So this two-state model was used on wet-dry data and then verified on travel rates where the position data was available. And we found that there were multiple discrete staging areas, both during the southward and the return migration. And these included that North Atlantic area. We tested the migratory connectivity between populations by calculating a mantle correlation coefficient by breeding and wintering populations, and found a high degree of mixing between those populations. As you can see in the bar charts here, although there was some evidence of population-specific staging areas with the Svalbard birds utilizing areas further to the west and the Scottish birds using more coastal areas to the East Atlantic. So we tested this variation formally by using the breeding and wintering population strategies in a general linear mix model. And the interactions between population and migratory direction were included as fixed effects. We found there was a significant interaction of migratory periods and breeding periods with fewer days spent on stopover during the spring migration compared to the southbound migration. And this reflects the time energy migration theory. A similar pattern was observed during the proportion of time spent on of stopovers. But this still leads some open questions. We've been able to identify some really important key staging areas, but what we weren't able to include in this first analysis was the overlap in space and time. So something that we're still interested in, how birds are utilizing the same areas, how this mixing with different populations occur. Are they using the same sites at the same time or consecutively? And how do these aggregations of seabirds link to population-specific trends? So we're currently working on a data set of the global status of Arctic skuas, the regional abundance, the recent trends, local threats and productivity. And seabirds are one of the most threatened groups of vertebrates, and almost half of all species of seabirds are experiencing these massive population declines that are spored. But there is a huge amount of variation throughout their range, and we're interested in how the connectivity of birds may explain this. So I started looking at spatial temporal explicit visualizations of connectivity between individuals of discrete populations over these complex routes using these discrete sites, stopovers and wintering sites, and if this can explain these population-specific vital rates. So the first off, just looking at the population level, I think this is a really interesting way of exploring or visualizing how different populations connect with each other and potentially the differentiation of different migratory strategies. So this is the first look, but I'm in the process of extending this to an individual specific model and looking at how these interactions in space and time reflect the local, the breeding population and the population's rate. And this has impacts for understanding the relationship between Arctic skuas and their target species. So they're only going to go where the resources are, and those resources are all the other seabirds which are also experiencing these similarly worrying declines. It can provide insights into trophic levels throughout the marine environment from this trans-equatorial migrant. So the whole ocean basin ecosystem can be explored using this single species potentially. But going back to the question of the I titled this talk is there a critical mass, and could that be dependent on the prey species that the bird is parasitizing and throughout the annual cycle? This is a recent paper, again a huge consortium led by BirdLife International, and it demonstrates the sheer numbers of birds which are using this site in the North Atlantic. The Arctic skuas are utilizing both during their south and northwards migration. In terms of numbers, it's between 3 and 5 million individuals are estimated to use this site and this bird species across this taxa. And what's really interesting is that all these different species are taking advantage of different trophic levels. Some are deep divers, some are surface feeders, and the Arctic skua is known to depredate and take advantage of all of them. So potentially there's an extremely high local abundance of resources, not just in terms of bottom-up effect of the fish availability, but the seabirds that they can depredate. And it's currently being assessed for a marine protected area. But one of the open questions is, how does these massive declines in seabird abundance influence the strategies involved and used by Arctic skuas? Also, these mass aggregations of birds has a huge impact for disease transmission, with multiple populations both from the north and the southern hemispheres all interacting together at the same sites. And also, from the perspective of energetics, these long distance migrations can be extremely costly, as are these high energetic pursuit flights, and how this balances out for this species. So the next step would be in identifying these key oceanographic features and also the target species that they're parasitizing, not just in the North Atlantic, but the other key staging areas that have been identified and the wintering areas. So in the last few minutes, I just want to change tack a little bit and think about smaller birds. So I've worked extensively with passerine migration as well, focusing on nocturnal passerines. And what we see at bird observatories, which are uniquely placed because there's huge numbers of birds passing through, is this aggregation of species and heterospecific interactions at these migratory bottlenecks. We see highly synchronized departures, and everyone is familiar with the starling murmurations, but during peak migration, what we also see at these sites is these nocturnal migrants, which lift off at dusk, taking off together, circling, forming an aggregation, and then at some point making a migratory decision and departing. Throughout my PhD, I was interested in the intrinsic and extrinsic drivers of migration, including the endocrine regulation and energetic budgets. I looked into the orientation and navigational apparatus that birds use, and also the environmental influence on migratory decision making. But one area which is left to explore is the role of the collective in these decision making. So birds are highly concentrated at these sites, and it could be an additional parameter that optimizes migration is the transfer of information at these migratory bottlenecks, or the role of a collective intelligence in adult and young birds orientating. And this idea reflects some of the observations that we see from field sites during migration. We see very clear and narrow bands of species migration. So for example, bird observatories only tens of kilometers apart and will record high numbers of one species, but it's not at the other one, suggesting that these narrow corridors exist during autumn migration. We also are very much at the beginning of understanding how young birds learn optimal migration routes. And something I've been exploring is the use of a, I think I just had the wrong slide up, I'm really sorry. the use of a three-dimensional radar system to investigate how these flock formations could translate into optional departure decisions, orientation, and the ontogeny of strategy. So these three-dimensional radar systems are used currently for applied ecology. So for example, interactions with wind turbines offshore or birds flying through airports to minimize bird aircraft incursions. But I think it has a lot of potential for investigating these migratory decision making. And so at the moment I'm discussing with collaborators from Aarhus University whether this can be used for the smallest of the migrants where we see this potentially flock behavior at migration bottlenecks. And we could potentially use the tools that have been developed at the cluster to quantify the size and the structure of these migratory flocks throughout in the natural environment. And I would love to discuss this idea more. So finally, I'd just like to thank everyone who has been involved in this Arctic Skua collective. So all the PIs throughout these regions and the many, many field workers who are involved. My discussions with collaborators using this three-dimensional radar system at Aarhus University. And of course, a huge thanks to the cluster for funding me through the postdoc fellowship for their trust in my work and my ideas going forwards. The funders who have contributed to the work that I've presented today. Thank you.
It's beautiful. Thank you so much. I expect there are questions, and I'm happy to circulate the microphone.
Thanks a lot. So you mentioned at the beginning that they were monogamous. It was a monogamous species?
Monogamous, yes.
Yeah, uh-huh. Sorry. And so I was wondering if you had some ideas if they winter at the same place, if they migrate together, and who they choose when one of them dies. Is it in the wintering ground? And do they migrate together afterwards or something like that?
Yeah.
And a small side question is, do they steal also from their own species? Yeah.
Okay, that's a great question. So where we had both members of the pair, breeding pair, tagged, in all cases we found that they went to completely different breeding sites. Although the there was individual consistency in the migration. So even birds tracked for 6 years were highly conserved in the areas that they used. We haven't looked yet into the timing. And the second part of that question was, if they do lose their partner, could they potentially be selecting a partner from their wintering sites? We just don't know, but it's a really great question. I expect what they probably do is they use these club sites during the non-breeding period. So all the non-breeding birds are basically hanging out together just outside the colony, and they're probably forming pair bonds there. But it's a really interesting question. It's something that we don't know. It's, for these larger seabirds, it's very common that if they lose their partner, that they delay breeding again for a number of years. And when you see these huge population collapses, effectively, this is extremely worrying. In particular, when there's other threats, not just the fact that birds die in the environment, such as hunting pressures and incursions with marine and onshore developments and a lot of disturbance in some of the most southern latitudes. But I think the key one is prey availability, which we see from another study looking at foraging efforts. And your second question was, please remind me, steal from their own species. Yes. But they can do, they will also steal eggs and chicks from their other species. They're quite happy to feed their own chicks to another one of their chicks if times are lean. But the diet is hugely varied depending on the breeding location, and from the island breeding birds, it's almost entirely marine, but you see a large proportion of terrestrial vertebrates and other, even small passerine birds they're catching and eating in the diet samples. So I think anything goes.
Right, thank you. I have two questions, but I'll put one for now. You said that one of the things you want to investigate is how the young birds learn the migratory routes.
Mm-hmm.
But you also said, if I understood, that they don't migrate together, so the siblings don't migrate together, the pairs don't, so they're individual migrants.
Yeah.
So what is your hypothesis? What are the possibilities of how would they learn? If they don't learn, if they don't migrate in a social way, so they don't migrate as within their colony, what other possibilities do you test for how they learn to migrate?
Okay, I'm going to deconstruct that question a little bit. And so firstly, in the Arctic skuas, this is a really big open question, and it's the same for almost all seabird species, is that we just do not have the technology to track them in these early years. So for Arctic skuas, it's the first 4 years, they fledge, they disappear off to sea, and no one really knows what they're doing. So it is actually a big assumption that they are going to the same areas that the adults are. So even though particularly these pairwise migrations can be very highly dissimilar, there are huge numbers of birds all using these same sites. So when we start thinking about individual migrations, I think we really need to think about this in terms of there's just vast numbers of birds using these conserved flyways. And it might not be you're flying as a flock, which has a lot of cost benefits in terms of energetics of flight. We're thinking about geese or white storks, but there's clearly huge numbers of birds using these highly conserved flyways and staging areas. So these collective information, I think, is overlooked and could potentially be incredibly important, in particular in a species that is entirely dependent on other seabird species. So these earlier behaviors, one, we don't know, we would love to know, and this could be something that when we finally have tags which are small and transmitting, such as the Icarus project, we can actually get a handle on. And it's thought that these early years are used by young birds to just explore the environment. So this is potentially when they are meeting conspecifics on their migration and optimizing their routes.
But that would mean that in older years, once they have learned a migratory route, they always have the same route.
Yes.
Is that true?
Yeah, exactly. So this is what we find in the birds that we've tracked for multiple years, is that they're highly consistent in their staging areas. So the routes in between them. And this is, I think, particularly important when you start thinking about behavioral flexibility in terms of environmental change. And that if they're establishing their routes in the early years and then sticking to them, there's very little opportunity for this flexibility in suboptimal conditions, even though there is environmental buffering in the adult, and it's what you would expect. And these different stages and the phenology, how that is used to mitigate some of these changes and potential carryover effects, for timing when birds are returning to the breeding site. Does that answer your question? Great, thank you.
Great talk, thank you so much. Just a curiosity question. You said they're highly synchronized in their returns. Can you put that in perspective, like in terms of days?
3 days.
3 days,
yeah,
wow.
On average, within the population, but of course that's optimized for each population, so across populations.
Cool, thank you.
Yeah, hi, thanks very much. That was really interesting. I've just very briefly, I've just been putting GLSs on sooty shearwaters in the Southern Pacific, so I'm quite interested mm-hmm. in how the basic practicalities of how you attach these. So like was it just cable tie and glue wrapped around the band, or is that all it was?
Yeah,
and
exactly that.
Did that work pretty well? Yeah. You didn't lose too many?
We didn't. So people have instrumented sooty shearwaters, Grant Humphreys in New Zealand. So it might be a good idea just to get in touch with people who've done it before. What we found that the main determinant of whether the tag stayed on or not was just the batch of the Darvix, the plastic ring, leg ring that we used. So they're cable tied onto a Darvix. Sometimes we used an alphanumeric ones to enable reciting in the field, and then super glue. So yeah, basically how you imagine it, just don't super glue your fingers to the tag or the bird.
No, because we also put them on penguins in Antarctica, and we lost some where they were obviously just wrapped around. When there were birds of preening, they probably preened them off the end of the Darvik. And so, okay, so
we didn't come across any birds that had just lost the tag and retained the ring. So the whole thing was gone when it was gone, but it was very few. And we were returning each season. So even though some birds kept the tag on for 6 years, we made an effort just to take them off every year and put a new one on.
Mm-hmm. And may this, what you said is that they are colonial breeders. Mm-hmm. Could you elaborate a little bit about what that means? I mean, they steal food from each other. They have the nests next to each other. So is it just a sort of spatial arrangement that they are next to each other, or do they collaborate? Do they help each other? Do they feed the chicks of the neighbor? What kind of coloniality is there?
So I expect that the spatial arrangement, so this colony effect, is probably driven by the proximity to their host species. So they nest on open moorlands. So in island areas, it's probably quite limited to where they are. So it'll be an optimal area that they can nest, and also that is close to the puffins or the terns or the kittiwakes that they want to go and steal food from. And it's likely to be a defense strategy as well. They're highly aggressive, and they will defend their territories to the teeth when it comes to incursions from other birds and greater blackback gulls.
Neighboring birds would come in and
well, I think it's more to do with just a collective response. So imagine a great skua or a greater blackback gull coming into the territory. If you are by yourself, there's two of you to defend your territory. If you're breeding in a colony, it's all your neighbors want that other bird out. So they will, they'll lose eggs and chicks to greater blackback gulls and bonksies. So I think that's probably drives this spatial relationship within the breeding colony. But I don't think they're cooperative at all. So they're quite happy to steal their neighbor's chicks as well. So there's a trade-off.
Actually, I would have a quick question. I find this method with the 3D radar to capture multi-species flocks and their composition, I find it truly fascinating. And I was wondering if you could clarify a little bit, how can you sort like species, or is it possible by size or by the behavior? Or
yeah, this is a really great question. So there's already been work done looking at the wingbeat frequency profiles to determine groups of birds. So you can now distinguish between larger birds and different flight types and passerines. I don't think that we are anywhere close to being able to differentiate between the smaller passerines. So one way of titrating the groups that you're seeing with the radar is from these long-term ringing studies. So bird observatories are uniquely placed where all the birds go. So they're often at these migratory bottlenecks, and almost all of them conduct long-term monitoring programs where they're mist-netting, they're catching and ringing a proportion of the birds which are in the area to give an idea of the population structure, the birds, or the species which are flying through. So there is information on the likely species composition of these flocks from ringing data, but probably more importantly, in terms of the ontogeny of migration, the composition of adult and young birds vary across the season. So what I'm really interested in is potentially how the size of the and the composition of these flocks vary, and you can titrate that with the known proportion of adult and youngs, and how quickly those migratory decisions can be made, and also the repeatability, how consistent they are in their departure direction. Sometimes they might, they do disperse, but often they all head off in the same direction. And is that to do with the composition of experienced birds compared to birds undertaking their very first autumn migration? So don't get me wrong, I think there's a lot of intrinsic cues that they are using, navigational apparatus and genetic component, but they are there with lots of other birds, and these flyways are highly conserved. So why not use the social information that they have around them to optimize it? What you might be able to do, which I think is another interesting component, is the interaction between other species and the predators. So where there's lots of passerines, you'll also find lots of birds that predate passerines. So particularly at Faustabo, there's huge numbers of sparrowhawks that are there because you have these huge concentrations of migratory birds flying through. So that's another aspect to investigate, is the role of the predator in shaping the migratory decision making of the small birds.
Fascinating. Thanks. More questions? If not, thank you so much again, Kat, and everybody for coming. And yeah, we close for today. Thank you.